Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 14 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and the different guests go through the 1973 cult horror classic The Wicker Man, one section at a time. I'm joined on this week's episode by Lisa Wagner, the co-host of the Mystic Tea podcast and the writer of the book Positive Pagan. Lisa, how are you doing?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. Huge Wicker Man fan.
Good stuff. I mean, I've had people who've seen it the first time, I've had people who aren't really fans of it, and got people who aren't fans of it, so it was always good to have this different variety of conversations.
Absolutely, I appreciate that, yes.
So before we dive into the discussion about this scene in question, so after Howie has done his main search of the island, he goes back to the Green Man pub to have a bit of a kip for a few minutes before he resumes his search. And whilst Howie is back in the Green Man, Alder McGregor and Willow, they light a Hand of Glory, which is a candle made from the pickled hand of a corpse, to keep him asleep for under some period of time. So we sit here, Howie overhear their conversation, the question of how whether they want him to stay asleep so he doesn't disturb them, or whether he'd want him to at the right time. But after Howie pretends to be asleep for a while, and Willow has gone off to join the procession, Howie wakes up, sees the Hands of Glory, knocks it to the floor, and then knocks out McGregor, takes his Mr. Punch costume, and goes to join the procession. And with the rest of the scene mainly comprising the procession of the residents of Summer Isle, the stone circle on the island, and you see their celebrations and the depiction of their May Day culture and celebrations. Yeah, so yeah, before we dive into talk about the film, Lisa, what's your general history of the Wicker Man and we all know your thoughts of it, so yeah, your history of it.
Oh, my history. Yeah, I remember, I grew up at the time, in the 70s where TV was our babysitter. And I mean, I vividly remember seeing this movie. And spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it yet, but the ending, I remember being so flabbergasted because I'm the kind of person where, I can watch a war film and nothing happens, but Lassie starts limping and I start crying hysterically. So, with the animals and everything, I just remember my jaw dropping and watching it. And then that beautiful, final shot that movie was vivid and always looked forward to seeing it, because I grew up before, the VHS era kind of thing. And I think it was one of the first DVDs actually that I bought because it did start an interest in folk horror movies for me, especially, and also Christopher Lee. I mean, always have loved Christopher Lee. So it is such a vivid memory. And I'm just so delighted to see how many other people share this kind of reverence for the movie, because I think it's very underrated and it is a beautiful film. I just watched it again the other day and there's so many layers to it that, I must have seen it at least 50 times, if not more. And every time I see something new or a nuance, I went down this rabbit hole yesterday of the books that Howie's reading in the library, because I was like, what book is he looking at? That's really interesting. And there's all these wiki pages for it. And so, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies.
I was about, watching it originally in the 70s, watching it more times on DVD since then, after then. So interesting one that I've found talking with other guests is, which version are you more familiar with, or which one do you prefer? Because I know quite a few of my guests whom it was their first time watching the film in preparation for this podcast. The version they watched was the theatrical cut. Whilst for me, as I've said before, the version that I'm covering is the final cut. And I've also highlighted differences between both those versions and with the director's cut. So yeah, which version is the one that you tend to go back to?
I think, honestly, I just go back to the theatrical cut just because that one is much more available. But I did receive as a gift the whole Wicker Man compilation from Imprint. My younger son has a huge reverence for the Wicker Man as well, and he knows my fascination for it. So seeing all the different cuts, I mean, sometimes I, especially around May Day, I tend to, you know, break that out and watch all the different versions. And the other thing that I do is, it may sound strange, but I really love the soundtrack. And so I'll watch that YouTube clip of Paul Giovanni singing Gently Johnny, and it just... Yeah, I mean, it's such a beautiful soundtrack. But to answer your question, yeah, I think I usually watch the theatrical version, but I do have appreciation for like the final cut and the director's cut. I mean, it adds so much to it.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's like different places you can see, like we saw different Simon's pacing, different preferences for the different quotes of the film. Like for me, you mentioned the song "Gently Johnny." For me, I can't imagine watching a version of the film now that doesn't have that song in it. For me, that song is such an important part in setting the tone and the vibes of the film that I think losing it and having Willow's song and that associated dance be on the first night rather than the second night, it throws off the pacing a bit too much for me and
it goes too
hard, too fast.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I think... sometimes I sort of shy away from that part because it hurts that, you know, it got butchered so much in the, you know, original theatrical cut, but it adds so much to it. You're right. I mean, I can't imagine watching it without Gently Johnny. And the soundtrack itself is so beautiful. Like, I've also noticed, like, just the music that's, like, underneath, you know, some of the scenes that are just so beautiful. I mean, it really is a work of art on so many levels.
And I mean, yeah, we definitely talk about it a bit later on when we talk about the music done for the procession. But, and again, to everyone listening to it, I'm sorry if I sound like a broken record, but for me, so much of the power of the film comes from Paul Giovanni and Magnet's work on the score and the music, all the different folk influences and traditions from poetry and history, all those things vibe together to create such a unique and engaging soundtrack. And it's always interesting to hear like different bands perform versions of it. So a few weeks ago at time of recording, so on May Day this year in Pitch House Central Cinema in London, they did an anniversary screening of the film, and one of the things they had there was the band Broadside Hacks did live performances of the different songs in The Wicker Man.
Oh, that's great.
And what's also good was that that was recorded and shown to cinemas across the UK in a special screening on the summer solstice. So I was able to see, whilst I wasn't able to see it in person, I was able to see at least the recording of it and hear how that band interprets and plays Paul Giovanni's songs. And it's always interesting to hear how like the differences and different interpretations that different bands have of that music and how it would play being performed live rather than on the soundtrack. But going into this section of the film, so starting off with how we're going back to the Green Man pub and going to that Steve's for a little bit, getting a bit of sleep to recover his energy.
Yeah, because he went through so much, you know, going through the village, so yeah.
And getting that bit of whiskey as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's first to work searching an entire island.
Yeah. Yeah, especially going door to door. So, yeah, that is such an amazing scene. And the other scene I really like as well is where everybody's gathered in the courtyard for, you know, to get ready for the procession, and just how... you know, just sort of commonplace that is, you know, because they're getting together to do, you think, oh, this nice little folk festival kind of thing. And, you know, there is sort of this undertone of, you know,
menace
and ominous. Yeah. Yeah. This menace. And it just cracks me up because it plays against each other so well.
Yeah. And, you know, as well, but I think the obvious why, like, you get that tone works is a lot of it because of Christopher Lee's form, so how casual he acts in it.
Yes. Yes. And how natural. Yeah. Like how naturally he you know, he, I mean, he's a superb actor, obviously, but yeah, I mean, wouldn't you want to live on his island? I mean, it just was, you know, it's just like how relaxed he is. And then, and I remember as a child being surprised at like, oh, he's wearing a dress. That's interesting. And, you know, what that symbolized, you know, made me curious because I was like, why would you do that? And then once, you know, I got older and I could look into it, that was, you know, a festival rite, you know, so that was really interesting too. That's an important part of the procession because, you know, he's leading it and guiding it and controlling it. And it's not just this, you know, festive little walk, you know, on the island. So I love that undertone of menace in it.
Yeah, and then also like going into like undertone of menace and results, ways for different rituals, controls, we get the Hand of Glory, with which is placed in Howie's room by the McGregors. And
yes,
it's always interesting seeing how like the Hand of Glory crops up in different forms of media and how different forms of media have presented it. So like for me, my first introduction to this artifact was in the Harry Potter series, where like being used as a candle that gives light to the wielder. And then see other like forms of media, like there was the Constantine TV series with Matt Ryan from, it was about 10 years ago now, where essentially like used for as a resurrection ritual. And seeing all the different ways that the Hand of Glory is presented here, and here it's shown as like something to send people into a deep sleep. What are your thoughts like how the Hand of Glory is presented here?
You know, that is interesting because like even as a child, I was sort of, you know, when you think about it, you're sort of, you know, I was puzzled. Like, well, did you really want him to go to sleep? Because isn't the whole point that he's supposed to join the procession and, you know, see this ritual to the end? So I always found that a little bit puzzling, but also it's such an important element of folk horror because that was actually used in a lot of pagan practices and, you know, different beliefs as to the power of it. You know, resurrection, like you said, obviously, because it, you know, comes from a corpse. And I just found that sort of an interesting little injection into the scene because it does sort of puzzle you a little bit. It's like, okay, you were using it. These are pagan practices on this island. But did you really want Sergeant Howie to take a nap? Or was this all part of an elaborate play? Which, you know, you find out that it is. And it just, that always fascinated me as a child. And also it ties into a lot of just like the folk horror genre. You know, there's a lot of time spent in cemeteries, which, you know, in this movie there are as well. You know, and the big deal between consecrated and unconsecrated ground and all the different ways that people view death. I just thought it was an interesting addition to the script that I, you know, to this day is just like, I watched the scene again the other day and I was just like, really, did you really want him to sleep? What was the point of that? Was it just more for shock value? Like, why did the director add that to it? But it serves its purpose because, you know, you wake up, you know, Howie sort of wakes up and sees it, and that look of horror on his face is well worth it. So
yeah, I mean, it was for me, when I was watching it, I interpreted it as they were deliberately being that loud for Howie, like having the door wide open. And to me, I always felt that Howie, especially when he heard them start talking, he was pretending to be asleep so that he could overhear what they were saying. You know, then they could see the Hand of Glory, and then Howie gets the idea that they don't want him to go somewhere. So they know that,
so that spurs him on, yes.
That spurs him on.
Yeah, there's so many layers to that scene. I mean, it just, yeah, because it makes you think, you know, how elaborate this plot was, you know, to get Howie to join in on the procession.
And it's also where, just looking at parts of the original script, that like the Hand of Glory was meant to have been set up slightly early on in the film. So, like, when Howie first goes to the graveyard and he's talking to the caretaker, and we talk about the depths of which the bodies need to be buried so that people don't steal the hands to make their own Hands of Glory. And so, right, like, this bit would be a bit of a payoff to what was would have been set up. And also that some people are definitely in the, well, I've read the book, Inside the Wicker Man, that the Hand of Glory scene comes a bit out of nowhere and seems a bit more overtly supernatural for some people. Well, again, for me, I always viewed it as more of that mundane, it's they're deliberately playing with him.
Yeah, but I really like the fact that throughout the movie, which I greatly appreciate, you know, as a practicing pagan, that, you know, that is part of the folklore history throughout many different kinds of traditions. And so I love that it is a focal point of that scene. As well, you know, because even if you're not familiar like with paganism or pagan practices, you're sort of like horrified and enchanted in a way by like, ooh, you know, this magical stuff, like what was this, you know, that maybe got people to explore a little bit more of, you know, like local histories and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. And so then, like, going on from that, we get how we like knocking out McGregor and taking the Mr. Punch costume. And so firstly, like a little behind the scenes detail of that bit was definitely for the actor Lindsay Kane plays McGregor. That's like this whole section was filmed just after a bit when, due to like paranoia, brought about like alcohol, drug use, and also being a period where he had pretty much nothing to do for quite a while since, you know, this, you know, before this section was filmed, they were filming all the sections later on, or the scenes when Kemp wouldn't have been on screen. So there was a point when Kemp, after a night out, had his taxi driver take him back to London rather than staying in Scotland, which is a pretty... pretty long drive from Scotland to London. And as soon as Kemp got back, he had a telegram waiting for him from Robin Hardy, begging him to come back to the set. So, and so this scene with the Hand of Glory was filmed after that telegram.
Yeah. So I mean, did he come back and film the part where he's like tied up and struggling?
Yeah, he came back to film that bit. But I don't know if you noticed it, but when like we see the cutbacks to that bit later on, like in the section in the film, you can see like how his legs in shots.
Yes. See, like every time you watch it, you see something different.
Even scenes you probably weren't meant to notice.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, also like thinking like with you, for you like as a practicing pagan, like with the history of like the characters and symbolism used like in the procession and the roles that the people place. So for example, this movie right now we've got McGregor playing the role of Mr. Punch. So I've mentioned in previous episodes my knowledge of Mr. Punch, you know, the seaside Punch and Judy shows, and also like the history that Punch has, definitely in terms of design, owing a bit more to the Italian commedia dell'arte traditions. Definitely you can see with the mask has and the elongated nose, which, you know, felt right at home with the commedia dell'arte. Yeah, it's interesting, like, here, if you as a practicing pagan, like what like knowledge you have of the characters of that are presented?
Yeah, that is a great question, because in my watching of it, I was more, well, I think the Punch and Judy part, I just thought that was sort of like a wink and a nod, and I've always thought of it that way, where, you know, again, that idea of control, you know, like, because Punch, you know, is very active in, you know, in, you know, the fighting part. And then there's that scene where the women encircle him. And, you know, the other thing I noticed when I watched it again was like the part about sort of like a throwaway line where they say, oh, you have to get going because, you know, Lord Summerisle wants you to get like a 5-minute head start. And I just thought, well, why? Because then they come back and, you know, they're poking and prodding Punch, you know, which is, it also is like foreshadowing, isn't it? Because it's just like poking and prodding him along. Yeah. Whereas he was supposed to, and I love that part where Christopher Lee is just like, cut some capers, man, you know, and, you know, be more active. And, you know, because he is just agog at this procession and what he's supposed to be doing and trying to observe to see if he can find Rowan and all these things. And then these women come out of nowhere when they have a head start to just, you know, poke and prod him. I thought that was really an interesting addition to that scene as well, because again, it's like foreshadowing, like poking and prodding the beast to get his, you know, his ire up, you know, for later on when it all is revealed. I just thought that was really fascinating. And the other one was the salmon of knowledge. I was just like, I never really thought of salmon being knowledgeable, you know, so that sent me down like a research rabbit hole as well. But it does throughout the movie. What I love about paganism is it's tied to nature. And so there is that theme of nature throughout the whole movie, of how unnatural, you know, Howie is when he comes in, because, you know, he's just a very active Christian. And they're just, you know, if you notice, they're all like so nice to him. Like, he is horrible and rude and cranky, and everybody's just like laid back, and we're going to have the celebration, and, you know, it's all about the crops and, you know, celebrating nature and then making an offering later at the ocean. And so I found that really a lovely tie-in to the core of paganism, like the call to nature. They're all dressed up in animal masks. And and once again, Punch stands out because everybody else is sort of in a, you know, with animal masks.
Yeah, I was definitely mentioning up throughout the podcast that Howie is, he is a dick to the residents of Summer Island.
He is, yes. Exactly. And they're just like so nice to him, no matter what, you know, how rude and abrupt he is, which, you know, I mean, speaks to, and I think that was part of the theme, is just like, this is the natural way that they live. And you're trying to go in and change all of it up, make it uncomfortable, you know. So definitely sticks out in that scene, too, because he sticks out like a sore thumb, because everybody else is just, you know, fish or, you know, goats or, you know, other kinds of animal symbolism.
Yeah, and that's who we've got Howie. Well, I mean, up until, you know, the burning Howie alive in the giant wicker man, who were they hurting through their religion? I mean, most, yes. Like, this year's, like, don't see anything that they really deserve again until they kill Howie. But even then, as I'll mention in future episodes, for them, it's an honour. They consider it to be the highest form of reverence that they can have for him.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's not like, you know, he was... It was willy-nilly, and what's really interesting too is like he had several chances to get out of there, and he didn't because he was so stubborn and determined. Like, he did have a couple of times where he could have, you know, they gave him options, you know, where he might not have been a virgin anymore if, you know, he'd listened to Willow. So, you know, so he had a chance to get off the island or just not end up being where he ended up. So, I mean, it gives you a lot of stuff to think about, the whole movie. So many layers, like I said.
Definitely. And it's just another mark of how good Edward Wood's performance is throughout the film, that especially as the film goes on later stages, you can find that balance of, you know, making Howie a pretty horrible person to the rest of Summer Isle, but at the same time, you do kind of see what he's thinking of. That's, for him, the rest of Summer Isle, just a deranged cult of murderers.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the movie does do a great job, and it shows, like, his amazing acting skills where, I mean, you do feel sorry for Howie, and you sort of see his dilemma, and you sort of see him just be a little bit drawn by their practices, just like, oh, you know, oh, that's interesting. Like, you can just tell because he lives so rigidly and so controlling that to see like this sort of freewheeling island and how they live, while he's shocked, there is a part of it, I think, that does appeal to him. And Edward Woodward does such a great job of conveying that.
Yeah, and especially, like, think of, well, with the costume design as well. Say, like, this scene example I've mentioned over episodes, that up until this point, whenever Howie's on screen, aside from when he's in his bedroom, he's in full uniform at all times. Like, and yes, it's always, like, full buttoned up, tie perfectly straight, police cap on, and very rigid in that way. But then you can contrast it with, like, the Resident Summer Isle in this section. Like, you've got Christopher Lee with in a busted yellow jumper and jeans and what look like Converse trainers.
Right, yeah.
And with a purple dress on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and even like Edward Woodward's pajamas, I mean, they look like they're ironed, you know? He does a great job of conveying like the stiffness and the, you know, the uncomfortableness with anything outside of his rigid purviews.
So yeah, then I think this is a good way to actually get into the procession itself. And it's interesting where it's actually not sure exactly how much of Edward Woodward's performance is in the procession, because reading some of the behind the scenes details, some of it would have been, some of the section would have been filmed with Woodward, some of it would have been with a stand-in, which you can get away with how he's wearing a mask for the whole section. So, but even still, it depends on how much Woodward's in it or his stand-in. In any event, it's always, the performer does a good job at showing the way that how he moves in this section. Like, he's very, he's more just like, as he said, just taking the whole thing in and feels more shocked that this kind of like freeness and the resonance of morality can be expressed, whereas for him, religious practices to the place of the like formal church services, he doesn't expect like yes. this kind of freedom for religion. For him, it all has to be regimented and arranged and following strict ideals and readings and all this stuff that feels in direct contrast to the freedom of the Summerisle paganism.
Yeah, because I think too, I mean, I think he's shocked at how happy they all are. I mean, because, I mean, that really is the first time he's seen pretty much all of the islanders together, and they are quite happy, you know, and laughing and cutting capers, like Christopher Lee says, and that I think part of that is a shock to his system as well, because, I mean, he's so laser focused on finding Rowan that I think that sort of seeps in, and it does such a great job in conveying that, even though in costume. And oh, and the funny thing I noticed when I saw it the other day too, was the remark, and it seems like a throwaway remark, but how Lord Summerisle says to McGregor, like, oh, are you going to be able to fit into your costume, you know? And he's like, yeah, the costume keeps getting smaller every year. And I thought, well, he is actually sort of skinnier than Edward Woodward, although how can we tell, because he's always buttoned up in his uniform. But I thought that was an interesting little line, like, so what would that mean? Like, was the costume too big or too small for him, you know? Like, would they have noticed? So I thought that was really
or was that line actually directed to McGregor, or was it something that they wanted Howie to hear, so they could think there was a costume yes. that he'd be more likely to fit in?
Yeah, see, so many layers. So exciting.
And yeah, definitely, especially with the reveal of what they want Howie for, wanting Howie to, feels like they wanted Howie to have the Mr. Punch uniform costume specifically. So it feels like once they'd got Howie there, they could literally get the measure off him, adjusting yes. the costume accordingly to make sure that it could fit him.
Exactly. And then, you know, and later then you see he actually has his, and he still has his uniform on underneath. I mean, yeah. not the jacket part, but I was like, he still had his tie on and everything.
Yeah, definitely like the shirt and formal
and
trousers.
The tie, yeah.
And like smart footwear. Again, conscious with the other as somewhere else, most of them like wearing like boots or trainers. Stuff that would be more conducive to that this kind of procession.
But yeah, but well, like McGregor is sort of in physicality, so he looks littler than, you know, Edward Woodward. So when you see the costume, it is very like filled out, and I thought that was really an interesting line that got me thinking, like, wait a minute, you know, if the costume was getting tight, you know, like, why did they have this line in there, you know? And it sends you down rabbit holes. I love that part.
Yeah, it's something where definitely I've been doing this podcast. It's one where I can't really discard any line of the Wicker Man or any bit of imagery. You can think of every part of it is building up of the mystery and the manipulations of Howie.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, yeah, you know, he's supposed to be the fool, yeah. among other things. And perfect costume for him, too. And you know what other thing that struck me was, like, His mask is, you know, paper mache or whatever, and it is very rigid, but so much emotion is conveyed in you know, the way he holds his body and, you know, the shock. I mean, you can just sort of see it throughout that, which I thought was really impressive, because by all rights, I mean, that is a rigid mask. You know, how
and
he
covers and it covers like all of his face.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it's like a sign of like the skills of the actors to properly convey emotion, like with the full head being covered. And it's definitely something where with actors and then stand-ins, you definitely see like more stuff like that nowadays. Thinking stuff like The Mandalorian as an example for ways that actors can convey a great deal of emotion, just their body language and movements of their head rather than like just facial expressions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah, that really struck me. It was like, that was such a cool part of it as well, just to see, you know, the building terror.
And then also thinking about the costume, there were some parts of the costume that Edward Woodward wasn't happy with. Particularly, there was a cod piece that was meant to be worn with the costume that Woodward flat out refused to wear.
Yeah. Although, you know, when they were poking and prodding him, I bet he missed it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also, like, it says about, like, the poking and prodding, interesting which of the rest of Summer Isle are doing that part of it. Because it's Willow, Miss Rose, and the, like, person at the records office played by Ingrid Pitt.
Yes.
So all, like, the, like, blonde women on the island. And so it feels like, you know, deliberately chosen those like three people fall like their like say something like this, but like their physical attributes to as for their role in the procession.
Yeah, and it makes you think, like, is that always part of the procession, you know, the interaction, you know, sort of like them being the Judy to the Punch and Judy part, and they're really giving it to them. as is done in Punch and Judy puppet shows. I thought that was really interesting, and how he sort of conveys a bit of surprise, you know, in that scene, like, what are these women doing to me, you know, kind of thing, like it didn't occur to him or something. So that's really interesting as well. But also that they are sort of like the spokespeople, you know, in a later scene, that, you know, the women seen as what, like goddesses, you know, as the matrons, the mothers, the maidens of the village, yeah. You know, so that they take that role on to sort of, you know, knowing it's Howie, that they sort of poke and prod him to sort of prime him in a way to for the later scenes, or, you know, and or it's part of the general procession that, you know, probably they did every year with McGregor. So it's interesting. It makes you think, you know, which one is it? Is this part of what they normally do? But it has an added layer because it is Howie and they know it. So,
yeah, I mean, definitely, like, in terms of way we presented, I've mentioned previous episodes, like the Willow song, how that plays as a siren song for Howie. It's just thinking of it, of stuff like in that area. And then, yeah, I mentioned like the maids and the mother, the crone, those figures in folklore, and that kind of ideals of how different forms of different cultures and different aspect of mythology are embraced by the residents of Summer Isle. And then I think also, time to talk about the actual music for all the procession. And yeah, again, there's another great bit of work from Paul Giovanni. And there's also an interesting one where originally it was meant to be performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. Like, Giovanni hired the brass section of the London Symphony Orchestra to perform the procession music, and they sounded too good. Like, it didn't.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. That would have happened, yes.
Yeah, it sounded good, but it wouldn't have felt right for it to have sounded that good, because I think of it more as like talented amateurs rather than full on professionals. So it fits being that slightly rougher, if that's the right way to describe it, way that the music was presented. And it does a great job at conveying like the gleeful atmosphere of the procession.
It does. And then it sort of turns into almost like a funeral dirge, you know? I mean, it's just like the, which I could sing, but I won't. it just sort of sounds, it starts out like really happy, but then towards the end, if you notice, it gets more and more ominous, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's also with the instruments that you use, like, as it starts, you get more woodwinds and brass instruments, or but then as it goes on and it gets darker, it's more percussion, it is just that steady drum beat.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that too. Another wonderful layer. You know, the music itself is just so stunning. And I wish there was more. Do you have more information on Paul Giovanni? Because I look it up and I don't really see a whole lot. But I mean, what an amazingly talented man. I mean, he added so much to this movie.
Yeah, definitely. It's one where, definitely in terms of magnets, I think, like, the band was formed specifically for the Wicker Man, so nothing really did anything after that. But, yeah, for most of it, even, like, just looking on Wikipedia, stuff like that, there was a play he did, like, there was an adaptation of a Sherlock Holmes story. But the entire thing on, like, just general Wikipedia page and just generally known about him is the score for the Wicker Man before his death. But yeah, the whole thing is, yes, it's pretty much isn't really known outside of the Wicker Man.
Yeah, agreed. But what a beautiful soundtrack. I mean, it is one of my favorites.
And yeah, it's also like good because of the way that Giovanni and Magnet have used different instruments in the film. Like, it's only like in the next section of the film when we get some like electronic components, but for like the majority of the film, it's more traditional woodwinds and brass instruments, and also more like traditional forms of instruments, and even other bands that have covered Giovanni's music for the Wicker Man, they always use those traditional instruments. So that's actually the anniversary screening of the Wicker Man in London that like, the band performed. They were using the same types of instruments that Giovanni and Magnet used when they recorded the score for the film, and the way all those instruments are used, it has that unique vibe to it that you don't really get from other films. Even other folk horror films don't have the same tone of the music that this one does. Like, as mentioned before, that in terms of like horror films, this is probably one of the only horror films that I can describe as a full-on musical. But even other horror films that are musicals, they tend to play it for comedy. So things of like Andrew and the Apocalypse or Little Shop of Horrors, like they use it to create a tonal dissonance, whereas The Wicker Man uses it to build on the tone and creating that folk vibes for them that helps create, and also aided by all the songs being diegetic, it helps create a more realized view of Summer Isle.
Yeah, another layer of this movie that is just so wonderful. I mean, I can't even imagine this film without such amazing music. And, you know, and it showed an appreciation for, you know, that kind of music that, like you said, used the traditional instruments and things like that. Whereas in other films, it's more, like you said, electronic or used for effect. But yeah, I mean, it is part of, I think, the building ominous feeling you get throughout the movie. It's so effective and it's such an amazing accomplishment, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also like, works so well with the tone and doing everything to create an understanding of the rest of the Summer Isle. Like, especially with the scenes earlier on in the film, we can imagine all the songs being formed like by the bands in the Green Man pub and all the like pub sing-alongs and...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know even as a kid, I was like, I want to go to Summer Isle. Like, I mean, it even though it's like this mounting horror, at the same time, there was something so beautifully appealing to that place. And I mean, how many of us wish we could go to Summer Isle and, you know, stay a while and hang out in the Green Man pub.
But yeah, it's also like in terms of like when you're filming, like, making good use of the environment of Scotland and most films around Dumfries and Galloway, some parts on like the areas around the Isle of Skye or Plockton. It's knowing what parts of Scotland to use to create this kind of idyllic vibe of it. And again, you mentioned all the rest of Summer Isle being this outwardly friendly, feel more accepting from the residents of Summer Isle than you do from Howie.
Yes.
And so there's sort of that vibe where you do start to question like which areas your sympathies lie with, whether you feel that Howie is just overreacting to everything because of his rigid puritanical nature, or whether there is something more sinister going on, and it's only really towards the end of the film that we get that he does start to go more into the overtly sinister.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, the locations are wonderful, but I always found it sort of universal because, like, my family comes more from, like, the Germany and Austria, and there are parts of both those countries where there are villages that are like that. You know, it's just very keep to themselves, you know, live, you know, with nature, you know, musical evenings, the local pub, you know, that kind of thing. So that's one of the beauties of this movie is, like, how universal it is while also being very specific to that area. Cause I mean, can you imagine filming it anywhere else? Cause I can't, but, just, it's just another layer of this movie that is just so wonderful because I mean, cause even as a child, like I didn't grow up necessarily like what I call folk magic. Like my family wouldn't have referred to it that way, but it was sort of prevalent where, you know, even as a child, I recognized like sort of elements of it, which I think also adds to its universal appeal and why it's still so popular all these years later. I mean, cause it is an amazing movie.
And then also, nothing that's, again, was interesting to ask for you, like, as like, you're practicing pagan, is actually this kind of procession and, like, how it's, like, practitioner was, like, feel of it as a representation of pagan religions.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, certainly the pagan festivals I've been to, we certainly have bonfires.
hopefully the police officers in them.
Per se, or effigy, but yeah, it... I mean, and processions and music and it's just, I think it's a universal of like a way of life before, you know, organized religion got to it. So I think, I mean, it's just the basic form of human life basically is unfolded in this movie. And it's just, you know, you're sort of lulled into like, oh, this is actually a really cool place. And, you know, until you get to the final scene and then it's like, oh, but yeah, sacrifices are made, obviously. You know, we don't go for humans, but things just, it is a form of honoring. Like you said, there is this feeling of like, this is an honor, Howie, you know, but in their minds, because you do make offerings like to nature or to gods or goddesses of whatever your, you know, your pantheon is. And, but there's a lot of joy in it, you know, of dancing and singing and being happy and being open to, you know, nature and its rhythms and things like that. So I think the movie does a great job of conveying that.
Yeah, and it's also one where I definitely feel like other folk horror films or films like presenting paganism or stuff like that, they tend to be more overtly sinister with it, with how it's presented. And you definitely feel like coming from a like Judeo-Christian perspective, seeing that those kind of religions as inherently distrustful. And so you wouldn't see in like other films like of this genre trying to do anything sort of that makes it feel more as appealing, creates those questions in the minds of the viewers like The Wicker Man does. Like, exactly think of like stuff off the top of my head, stuff like, say, The Craft, which has that, which definitely for me plays that religion more as something overtly sinister and something distrusted, or stuff like Midsommar, which presents it as the cult that's engaging in overt manipulation and is more directly sinister and blatantly like bloodthirsty, for lack of a better term, throughout the film. Right. Whereas with The Wicker Man, he's only at the end of the film when we actually get to the Wicker Man itself, and we get those overtly sinister elements. And the general thing is, it's criticism is for the people rather than the religion.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. Definitely agreed. Yeah, because it is. It's funny because it is basically two groups not knowing what the other is doing, and that's where the tension comes in. You know, he's suspicious of what they're doing, and you know, and it's almost like they're not suspicious of what he's doing because it's almost like they have his number, you know, and play him like a fool, as it were. And in other movies, I think it's this constant like tension of just like, oh my God, why do they act that way? Why do they do these things? You know, that's not what regular people do kind of stuff. So yeah, this is such an interesting, unique movie about that.
Yeah, like you mentioned it earlier on when we actually talked about the history of Summer Island, the way that the pagan religion was brought back to the island. But it's one where you, for other films like this, like ones that present paganism, you wouldn't really get those discussions, like philosophical discussions about the nature of the religion and like the general, for lack of a better term, the joy of the story of the religion. And a lot of films they present like the Christianity or like those that are like the Judeo-Christianity religions as the moral superior just by virtue of its being Judeo-Christian. They wouldn't have like some like get that bit of early on when they're doing the discussion of when how he's talking about working out sexual intercourse and how he's just that this whole bluster of oh that's preposterous and Lord Summerall, yes. And Lord Summerall brings up the Virgin Mary. Other films wouldn't try and make those comparisons between Judeo-Christian religions and paganism.
Yeah, that's another unique part of this where there is like discussions. They're trying to have these discussions with him. I mean, he shuts it down, but it just is. It is interesting. It's funny you bring up Midsommar because I remember going to see Midsommar like at a midnight showing. And I remember leaving it going, what the heck did I just see? But it, at the same time, it just did. It did feel like, oh, this is, you know, sort of like the Wicker Man in my head, because the Wicker Man to me is like the pinnacle. But it was a lot more violent, obviously. And just again, it's just this sheltered little, you know, community and how they do things, you know, and then you see it. And it was funny because in a way, when you see Midsommar, you are like sort of like Howie, like, whoa, like what is going on here? And I never really thought of the two like that in that comparison because I remember just going, what the heck was that? You know, but also, I mean, a very well done movie. And I'm glad to see folk horror, you know, people are remain interested in it, you know, that because I think it reached a really good peak in the like the 70s. And so it's nice to see, you know, that interest continues in films today.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I don't know if you've watched any of it and how widespread it got in outside the UK, but there was that history I mentioned previously in the podcast, the History of Horror series of Mark Gatiss, like 2009 2010, like that era period, which helped popularize the term folk horror, like, yes, to meet general audiences. And so it was really like from that point when you got like the bit of the resurgence of folk horror, and definitely with A24. Then I mentioned that directors like Ari Aster, Robert Eggers, Alex Garland, who are embracing the tone feel of folk horror and knowing how to use it,
yes,
to create effective horror.
Yeah.
But it's one where even those ones, there's, you know, there's some really great modern folk horror films, but there's still nothing that captures the same kind of tone that The Wicker Man does.
Yeah, it's definitely the pinnacle, in my opinion, of the movies. I know they always lump it with the trilogy with Witchfinder General and I forget the other one, but...
Blood on Satan's Claw.
Yes, Blood on Satan's Claw. But to me, the Wicker Man... It's so subversive, you know, and so, like I said, layered and so interesting. And it just, to this day, I mean, it still captures your attention. It's a shame it's not, you know, more well-known, because, I mean, I was so excited to find your podcast because I was just like, oh my God, there's other people that, you know, and finding like the Wicker Man groups, like on Facebook and things, where I'm just like, oh, I get to share this love with other people, you know, because it's not as well-known as I think it could be, but I think it's growing. I mean, I was so pleased to see like all the celebrations and everything for the 50th anniversary. So long may it continue.
Yeah, and definitely in terms of like getting more popular. Honestly, when I went to the screening of the film in the cinema at my local cinema in Cheltenham, it was, yes, a pretty much sold out screening.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
Granted, maybe just been because it was a one night only one, but in any event, just having a pretty full cinema of people just who have that appreciation for the Wicker Man, like staying through the full, like the full thing, like, because he had like the hour and a half recording of the event in Pitch House Central London and then the showing of the final cut. So it was like all in all a like 3-hour experience.
Oh, wow.
Like, not including adverts and trailers.
Yeah, so jealous.
Jealous.
But yeah, I mean, when you think about it too, I mean, in a way it was so ahead of its time. I mean, what a genius that this was created. You know, it wasn't just I mean that has so much resonance, like, here in 2023 is just mind-boggling.
And yeah, and also, again, definitely one where, I mean, I hate to bring it up, but it's also important to show why the remake doesn't work. Because, like, yes, the remake, they try to capture it, but I don't even really think they tried. They turned what was suspenseful and playful and dramatic and this engaging mystery film, and they turned it into a farce. Like, the remake of Wicker Man is considered a comedy and known for the memes rather than actually as a film. It's, when you think of the remake of Wicker Man, you think of Not the Bees. You don't think of anything else. You think of all the ridiculous moments of it. And that really helped demonstrate how, like, Neil LaBute's original remake didn't really get what he was making. It didn't end up as engaging. I mean, you could have done a really good remake of The Wicker Man, but yeah, they just completely botched it.
They did. And, you know, that, like, what we were talking about before was that the only thing to like about that movie is the setting and the production values, because it is a beautiful island. But yeah, it's just like he went off the rails or something. And you know, and it is a shame, because, I mean, there is no reverence for the original. I mean, they could have done so much more. And whatever, they chose not to, and who knows if it was budget or time or not just having any sense, who knows. But it's a shame, because you know, when I meet people, that's like sort of how I gauge, like, so have you seen The Wicker Man? And if they mention Nicolas Cage, I'm just like, no, and I have to redirect them to the original masterpiece, you know. So and it's a shame people have that as a reference, but again, it also shows up how amazing the original masterpiece is. So
yeah, I mean, even like Nicolas Cage is someone who didn't think that it worked. Like, I know that there was an interview he gave in 2012 where he said he would have wanted someone like Hideo Nakata, who directed the Ringu films, and right, he felt that he could have done a really good job with The Wicker Man. And it's something I imagine, yeah, I think, like imagine, like, Japanese version of The Wicker Man, or it's like the or like a Korean version, like, similar vibes. Something like that could be done really well.
Yeah, it could have. It was a missed opportunity, that's for sure. And it's a shame, because I do actually like Neil LaBute's plays. I mean, he is an interesting person with an interesting viewpoint, but I who knows what happened there. It's a blotch. It's a blotch on the beauty of the original one. So
yeah, I mean, if there's people who came to this original but through the remake, then, like, more power to them. At the very least, it could have brought attention to this original. But yeah, it just shows how much of a lightning in a bottle film the original was.
Definitely, definitely. I'm so thankful it was made.
Yeah. Before we finish, is there anything else that you want to talk about for, like, the film in general, or this specific section of the film?
Oh, the procession. Just that it is. It was interesting. I watched it, just that part of it, you know, just to prepare for this podcast. And it's so interesting to take it out of the movie and to just watch it. And it just gave me a new appreciation for how layered the movie is, which I've always had. But it was just like you said, like the undertone of the music and the costumes. Like I said, I went down this research rabbit hole of, like, all the different costumes, and like the Salmon of Knowledge, like I said, caught my attention. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, how that relates to, you know, folk, you know, magic and folk tales and things like that. And it was just, it's just really beautiful to watch. And I'm so thankful that you have this podcast that, you know, takes the parts of the movie that we normally would just appreciate as a whole, but now we can just really hone in on certain scenes and be like, wow, you know, just ever more impressed with what was created.
Yeah, it's definitely one where there's so much you can talk about with The Wicker Man that it really helps this kind of format works to just highlight all the different parts of thematic weight and the genius of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, then. And so with that, we've come to the end of the episode. Lisa, I want to thank you again for agreeing to take part.
Oh, thank you, Tony, for having me. This was such a joy. I can talk about the Wicker Man forever.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so before we get going, is there anything that you want to promote?
Oh, yeah, thank you. So like you said, I am a co-host of a podcast called Mystic Tea, and you can find it on Spotify, Apple, wherever you find your podcasts. And it's all about, I work at a metaphysical shop here in Western North Carolina, and it's all about members of our community that we have, you know, and have discussions that go down my favorite topics, all these great rabbit holes. And then my book, Positive Pagan, you can find on Amazon in the UK and wherever, you know, you buy your books, ask your bookseller to buy it if they don't have it in stock, and they can get it for you. And it's published by Llewellyn. And I hope you read it, and I hope you see the joy. The focus of my book was about the joy of paganism and celebrating it. So even if you don't consider yourself a pagan, they're all actions that you can do regardless of your spirituality. So I hope you'll give it a look-see on wherever you get your local books.
Okay, great stuff. And then for me, outside of this podcast, you find my main site where I do film reviews over at cougsreviews.wordpress.com, and you can find me on Instagram at @CoganTony. Lisa, again, thanks for agreeing to take part.
Oh, thank you, Tony. This was great.
Yeah, and to everyone listening, I'll see you again on the next episode.